This is The Lisa Show with Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T.
How closely do you watch your kids' grades? Well, coming up in about 20 minutes, probably not as close as you think.
ABBA. Yes, that ABBA.
Oh.
Has a new album. Yep. I wish I could call it. It's called Voyage. I wish they would have called it an ABBA-album. Listen, we'll talk about what people are saying online about it coming up in your buzz.
I'm pretty used to getting things exactly when we want them.
Mm-hmm.
I blame Amazon Prime.
Yeah, which is now. I want them now. I ordered them now. That's when I would like them.
And as a result, I think that we hear about newer and more hyped up products now more than ever. And sometimes a scarcity is created, but I wonder how much of it is perceived and how much of it is actual scarcity, right? Like, so if a new phone comes out or new technology and people want to create buzz about it, they may say it's like, you know, a limited edition or there's only so many before the model's sold out. And I wonder how much production needs to catch up for that and how that impacts us. But specifically, if you can get ahead of the curve, do you consider pre-ordering things? And it can be anything from entertainment to technology. And is that changing the way that we purchase items and we plan for them? Should you buy an unreleased product that you haven't seen? You just buying the hope of it, the promise of it.
The status of it in some cases.
Well, here to answer these questions is friend of the show, CEO of Midland Financial, Larry Sprung. Thanks for being here, Larry.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. It's a pleasure to be here.
When is ordering an unreleased product worth it?
Yeah, so I mean, listen, there's pros and cons with everything, and there's pros and cons with pre-ordering. And, you know, I think people have to understand the genesis of where pre-ordering comes from. And it's really a tool for the company. You know, it's really a tool for them to gauge how much product they're going to need and kind of get ahead of the game to some degree. And also, it's a marketing tool, as you mentioned in the intro, to create this scarcity mindset. So, you know, you have to think about it. Is it something that you really want and or need, or is it something that you're just kind of getting caught up in the hype of having? Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so the more that we do it, will this just become the model for ordering things?
Well, I think it is. I think, you know, again, I think it helps companies have a little bit more transparency about the demand around products. So, you know, if you think about it, and I could relate this to my son, for example, they have pre-orders all the time for sneakers. You know, he's a sneakerhead and they have pre-ordering. So think if you're a big sneaker, you know, producer, and if you think that a certain sneaker is going to have a certain amount of demand, and then you start the pre-ordering process and there's not nearly as much demand, then you could pull down, you could pull back the production of that item based upon the demand and perhaps limit your downside in terms of having product that's not going to be bought. So it's a great tool for the retailer. You know, it can be a good tool for the consumer, but there are certain things that I think the consumer should be aware of, you know, from a financial standpoint when they think about pre-ordering.
What are those things?
Well, I think one thing is you're essentially giving the company an interest-free loan because depending on the product, you may pay for it today, but, you know, that product may not come for 2, 6, 12, you know, 20 weeks. So basically, you've now given the company an interest-free loan. What if, you know, you think that this looks really cool and inviting, and when push comes to shove, you get the product or the service, whatever it is. What if you don't like it? Then what? And then I think another thing that they should think about is what happens if the price declines. So let's say the demand is there for the pre-ordering, but you know it's not that lucrative or sought after an item, and then the retailer has to reduce prices in the next month or two. You know, basically you're locked into that price and have very little, you know, recourse in terms of paying the lower price versus the pre-order price.
I never really considered that the price could fluctuate. In cases like that, when you don't like it or the price goes down, what are your options?
I don't think you have many. You know, I think, you know, the only perhaps recourse that you would potentially have is if you were to utilize a credit card that had purchase price protection.
Oh.
In that instance, I could potentially see an opportunity where you could then go to the credit card company, not necessarily the retailer, go to the credit card company and say that there's been a price reduction and see if they'd be willing to match it.
You know, it's interesting because if I feel like this conversation will be different depending on the product that you're considering pre-order. You know, a lot of people pre-order novels or, you know, streaming shows or things like that. You know, like I'm going to pre-order a pass to this or that. And then when you're talking about a phone or a piece of technology, it seems a little bit different. What do you think are the varying considerations you should make depending on the product?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is personal preference. I think with technology, for example, you know, many people want to be that early adopter, first to have. And if you're willing to take on those concerns in terms of giving the company an interest-free loan, you know, what if you don't like it and you know you're going to like it, or if the price could decline, if the overriding factor is being the first to have it, then, you know, that might be worth it to you, and that's fine. A book, for example, you know, typically, you know, in those cases, you're buying an author that you've, you know, read consistently, and they're coming out with the next book in the series. So you have a lot less risk there. So, I mean, that's something that's easily, you know, reconciled. You know, in terms of, I think one of the areas that is, pre-orders are very highly sought after also are on video, you know, in regards to video games and that market. And typically there's a track record there. You're not going to pre-order a video game that you haven't seen some iteration of or played previously. You know, I can think of, like, for example, NFL, you know, the Madden series or the NHL, you know, series through video games. You know, typically you know what you're getting. There's some enhancements. So there's very little risk there in terms of those. So I really think it depends on the product. And then, you know, you also want to buy from retailers that you know that are going to be able to deliver on their promises, meaning if they say that this product's going to release, you know, the pre-order is now, and then you're going to have the product in hand, you know, you want to make sure you're buying from retailers that are consistently delivering on those promises, because I have seen pre-orders in the past and they say they're going to be delivered at a certain time, and then for whatever reason, they are not.
We're talking with Larry Sprung about pre-ordering. First of all, what it is, if somebody goes, I think I know what that is, but also, is it worth it? And it was interesting, you know, we've talked about how from like the business or the marketing standpoint, why this would be valuable. I was listening to a podcast that I listen to pretty regularly, and they were talking about a pre-order of a particular book. And when they talked about all the things that came with the pre-order, you know, the ability to get access to an app and you get a free webinar and all these things, it ends up being a couple $100 worth of pre-order bonuses for getting on the bandwagon early. And I thought, why is it that they're doing this? And as I thought a little bit more about it, when, because of the way they track numbers and New York Times bestsellers, if they have all the pre-order, that technically counts as those orders going through within the first week. So they escalate that particular book to the top of the New York Times bestseller list, and that can give them that sort of fame and that. And so it's interesting to note, if we make our purchases because of where things get recommended from, to know why they're being recommended so highly.
I thought that 100%.
Was, yeah, 100%. I thought that was kind of fascinating.
And those additional add-ons typically, you know, from a cost perspective, don't really cost them anything or very little. And it's just a nice way to entice you to get that order in much earlier.
Is there anything that you've ever pre-ordered that you're kind of like, oh, yeah, I was really grateful? Or
that you'll always pre-order?
Yeah, I don't pre-order that often. I will tell you the last thing that I pre-ordered was actually a book that was supposed to be delivered at a certain time, and I didn't end up getting the book for like 6 to 8 weeks after it was originally expected to be delivered. But with that being said, it was still delivered before everybody else got the book. So I guess it was still worth the pre-order. But, you know, I think that's, you know, something. I don't pre-order things very often. I know my kids do, for example, you know, video games are mm-hmm. A big thing in our house. You know, the newest edition of some of those games I mentioned earlier. You know, technology and things of that nature, cars, we try to stay away from those so the bugs get kind of worked out before we end up buying them, you know, on that curve of technology,
sure.
Early adopter, mid-range and late. We're probably mid-range because we want to make sure some of those bugs are kind of, you know, worked out before we actually adopt the new technology.
From a budgeting standpoint, is there an advantage to pre-ordering, whether it be to paying that off or to saving the money to actually be able to afford it by the time it is delivered?
I don't think there's any real advantage other than the fact of when the pre-order comes, if you have the extra cash flow to afford it, it may be a way to kind of get that paid for before that money gets spent in other areas that, you know, you might not be as happy about later on, and you'll be happier that you have that item or that service or whatever you pre-ordered.
It seems to me that it's something that's here to stay and that people feel like a sense of kind of an emotion attached to it, you know, that status that you get for getting it first, you know, whether it's a novel or a piece of technology or even a car. Do you feel like these trends moving forward in retail will reflect that?
Yeah, I do. I think that, again, with the environment we're in and, you know, companies are trying to, you know, have better clarity upon their sales and, you know, have some, you know, better vision as far as how things or a particular product is selling. And I think pre-ordering really gives them that insight as far as how much demand is there going to be for this particular item. And I think you're going to see retailers and many different products start utilizing this methodology in order to get that further transparency.
Mm. I'm looking forward to selling my 10-part course in the future, Larry, and I hope that you will pre-order it now. I actually have just barely announced it just now, haven't created it. I'm hoping that you'll invest in the future with your pre-order. It'll come out sometime between now and 2055. Are any interest on your end?
You got it, yeah.
Oh, see?
I will commit my $5 now for the pre-order.
This pre-order thing is easier than I thought. This is great.
Lori, you know, it's funny that when we talk about different sort of trends, that we also feel like we can have an influence on others. Do you think that moving forward, this is going to be a benefit?
Again, I think it's a benefit to the retailers from a number of different standpoints. You know, again, the transparency with social media, people putting out there that I've, you know, secured my pre-order, which, you know, entices other people to join in because people like being part of a group. So I don't know that there's as much benefit for us as consumers as there is for the retailers, but you know, it's definitely a benefit to them, and I think we'll continue.
Making informed decisions as we move forward. I mean, we're all going to pre-order your course, though, Richard.
Yeah,
so don't even worry about it.
Sometime soon-ish.
Larry Sprung, founder and CEO of Mittland Financial, friend of The Lisa Show, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Now, coming up in about 5 minutes, how your children measure up to their own academic dreams?
Well, listen to this. If you change your mind,
okay,
I'm the first in line. I'd like you to take a chance on this morning's buzz. Take a chance, chance. Take a chance. Yeah, we're talking about ABBA. It's trending online. Nope. We're in 2021, I promise. I'll tell you what's going on coming up. You are listening to The Lisa Show.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Now, day to day, we normally perform activities that really do qualify as wins. Why should we celebrate them? That's coming up in about 20 minutes. But first, it's time for your buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online, likely will be talked or spoken about in your public place, your home place, or with this first one, definitely going to be spoken about in your workplace with the vaccine mandate. To roll out to affect almost 75 million Americans by the 4th of January. OSHA, that is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, has said, hey, guys, if you work outdoors, don't worry about it. So that's kind of interesting. If you have an outdoor job.
You're a park ranger.
Yeah, you mow a lawn.
You work in landscaping.
First you take the trash, put it in the bag, boom, boom, you got that, Jeff. Do you remember that old?
I don't.
Cleaning up the parks, forget it.
Oh, okay.
But if you're working outdoors, you have less to worry about.
I hadn't heard that,
With the vaccine mandate. Also today is Donut Appreciation Day. So I know what you're thinking.
Appreciation.
Is this the same as National Donut Day? And it's not.
Oh, okay.
So like when you get the free donut at various donut establishments, there may be some that observe Donut Appreciation Day. But I think this is really a time that we take a moment away from our fast-paced life and we truly, truly appreciate the donut. Now, how might you do it? Well, you could stop by your favorite donut shop and pick up a donut and be able to, you know, maybe try a donut that you've never tried before. Yeah. Like there's one you haven't tried before.
Can you imagine?
You can try out the best donut shops in your state. You know, maybe take a little bit of a drive.
I've
heard the one over in the town over the mountain is pretty good.
Always wanted to go over to What's-Its-Name Bakery.
You could also check out the book Donuts, An American Passion. And read about donuts and find out.
I'll only allow that if you're eating a donut while you're reading.
Well, here's the problem.
You'd be so hungry.
You have to purchase it because if you try and get that book from the library, all the pages are stuck together from all the donut sugar. So, I thought that was interesting. Donuts, An American Passion is the name of that book. And then finally, I took a moment to listen through all of the album ABBA. They released Voyage, the first album from ABBA in 40 years.
It's a long time.
Should have maybe waited 41 or 42.
Stop.
Really?
Because it's too anticipated, highly anticipated?
So here's what I love about ABBA. I sort of made that reference earlier to Take a Chance. Like, there's those kinds of song by ABBA, and that's what I really love.
Yeah.
They really leaned heavy into the ABBA ballad in this album.
Like, One of Us is Lonely.
And on. And you remember, the last time ABBA released an album. I can't say the two words in the same sentence. They used to make songs that were 5+ minutes.
Now, today, long songs.
Kids are used to songs that are like 2.5 minutes if they get beyond the first 30 seconds on TikTok. Several of the songs on the album are +5 minutes.
Wow.
So if you want
a
trip down memory lane, the voices distinct as they always have been with ABBA, that's enjoyable, but it's not the... it's not the rousing ABBA album that maybe we were looking forward to. Maybe that will be their next album. 40 years from now, I'll mark it down. 2061, let's do it. Your buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. Did you always know where you wanted to go to college? Or did you just apply somewhere that someone told you to? Did you imagine getting into that school, but you also knew what you needed to do? Or did you just kind of cross your fingers and hope? Were your parents someone who pushed you to get better grades? Or did that come from you internally? Do you feel like your grades mattered? All those different kinds of questions. Put yourself into that position. And maybe you are finding yourself navigating through that as a parent for the second time. Maybe you were finding yourself navigating that for the first time. No matter how you feel about college admission or grades or trying to find the right school, where do you find your information and how do you know that it's up to date and the best information? Well, who do you listen to? Well, we want to listen to Rick Clark as the director of undergraduate admissions at Georgia Tech. He's written about this and knows how to answer these big concerns and questions so that we get the most up-to-date information. Welcome, Rick.
Thanks so much for having me. Looking forward to the conversation today.
Well, I think sometimes people like to talk about college admissions, and for others, it just seems so nebulous and it's a little overwhelming, right, and stressful. So how did you start learning about this whole process for college admissions, and where do you get your information up to date?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I mean, you know, I've been working in this field now for about 20 years at a variety of institutions, and in doing that, have just had the opportunity to not only see how all of this sort of works internally, how recruitment occurs, mm-hmm. how admission decisions are made, but then also, you know, work alongside colleagues at lots of different schools and see kind of where those common themes are so that you're not just thinking about, well, this is how we do it at this one.
Sure.
Place. But
yeah.
What are those things that cut across lots of schools? Yeah.
And so when you talk to these colleagues and share information, and I appreciate you pointing that out, what have you learned?
Sure. Well, I think one of the big things, and to your point about families, is at the end of the day, college admission actually is all about relationships in a lot of ways.
Okay.
And I think that people lose sight of that sometimes, that, you know, it's looked at often as, hey, this is what we need to do, or this is what we have to do, instead of kind of flipping that a little bit to say, hey, we get to do this. This is a real opportunity and a real privilege in a lot of ways. College is not something that everybody gets to talk about or consider as an option.
Yeah.
So starting there, I think, is really important. And then looking at it as an opportunity to listen and talk big about goals and dreams and, you know, what everybody involved sort of wants and hopes out of this. Takes a little bit of the pressure sometimes off of the minutia of got to take a test, got to write an essay,
yeah.
got to fill out this application, got to meet a deadline. Yeah.
Yeah, a checklist. It's hard to get out of that mindset, having been in it and
true.
Having been a parent, helping my kids navigate that. So I'm curious as to why you think it's important for really students to understand this process in the way you're describing.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I even sort of challenge sometimes the word process, right? Because
okay.
process does make you think of this, you know, mechanical sort of recipe-like formula. And the truth is, every student is different. And, you know, the way they're going to go about this is different. And that's good. And that's okay. So to your point from earlier,
yeah.
if somebody has two kids or three kids, and I have, you know, multiple kids, like they're different.
Yeah.
And they need
oh, yeah.
to think about it differently. So I like to flip it a little bit and talk at it more like an experience, right? I mean,
okay.
you know, when you think about an experience, it does help you start to kind of breathe and say, we might not be able to control this thing fully,
right.
but some of the joy of it and some of the enjoyment of it is to see where it goes, right? To keep that perspective of, hey, let's sort of walk along together and discover more about who you are, what you want to do, the places that might match and fit, and let that lead instead of got to get to X point, like a process sort of directs.
Okay, so that's an entirely different paradigm shift. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Rick Clark about how you really navigate the experience, not the process.
Right.
Of applying to school. I think parents and students, this is a huge shift, right? And I have three kids in college right now,
okay.
at two different universities, one private and two at a state university, and it has been less of an experience for them and more of a process. Unfortunately, but I'm drawn to what you're saying. And I think that a lot of us feel like, okay, just tell us what we need to do. The essay's due this time. How important is
yeah.
the ACT or the SAT? You know, what kind of financial aid can I get? You know, they get down to the brass tacks. So when this experience is so overwhelming and people don't have the experience that you've had, where do you tell them to start?
Sure. Well, and look, you're going to get to those things eventually, and that's natural. Of course, you're going to have to talk about how to pay for it and when things are due and all the mechanics. And mm-hmm. so, of course, that is part of this. But I think really when you talk about most high school students at that sophomore level or junior level or, mm-hmm. or potentially even before that, too many people get focused on where before they ask the question of why. So,
okay.
you know,
huh.
just
that's a specific
hey,
thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, why do you want to go to college? Asking a kid that is something they usually don't get asked. And it forces them to start to think through, you know, what their purpose is and what their goals are. And that then can help to, you know, facilitate a conversation and an exchange between a parent and a student that's really different than, if you know, where, and then mm-hmm. must do X, Y, and Z to make that happen, right?
Yeah.
So I do think that that's a good starting point. I mean, I think for parents, and we talk a lot about this at Georgia Tech, this is an opportunity to start to shift, right, from being a parent to being a partner, to coaching and giving perspective instead of driving everything. And that kind of different relationship is where you need to get anyway by the time college starts and to kind of go through in a healthy way. But this is, again, an invitation to make that part of the high school experience too.
That's a really interesting idea, to make the parent less of, you know, pushing it and driving it, to be more of a coach. I'd love to hear a little bit more about what that looks like, with maybe some examples.
Sure. Yeah. And my you know, my visual on this is the driver's ed car where the parent might be in the passenger seat, like hitting the brake or steering.
Or like my son is like, there's no brake there, Mom. I don't know why you're pumping your leg there. And I'm like, oh, I know why I am, but go on. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But,
and I mean, I've done this both successfully and unsuccessfully in transitioning to be a coach.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a challenge. I mean, again, I'm thinking about my own kids. Like, I get it. We want to, you know, make sure that, you know, ultimately we want them to have good long-term success. And we see that sometimes they don't, right? So the immediacy of things, the urgency. But really in an ideal world, I think students would be able to be the ones to take ownership, right? To say, here are my goals. Here are some of the places that I think kind of align with that. Now, if we're going to go, let's say, visit a campus, you know, let's split this up a little bit. Instead of just the parent sort of concierging this whole thing, like, let the student get online and make that reservation. Maybe they should consider if they need to rent a car or book a hotel. I mean, there are some things that parents can do in the college admission experience that are going to be very important for kids when they get to college. I think we lose sight of this as parents sometimes, and we think, we just got to get them there. That's our job, right?
Yeah.
Once they're there, they'll be fine.
Enrolled, see ya in 4 years. Good luck.
Yes. Right? So I think too often we skip over college admission right to college, and we need to kind of back that up and say, how can we make this more like the college experience? Like, research is a big part of the college experience. Well, that should be part of the college admission experience. You know, taking ownership, advocating for yourself. Like, parents too often – and you may have seen or experienced this yourself, but like, the student goes to the college campus, they're going to have an opportunity to talk to an admission counselor, and all of a sudden the parents cut in front of the student to ask questions, right?
Yeah.
And letting the student have that opportunity to ask their questions, to determine what's important to them, to figure out how they're going to use their time when they go visit. You know, I think those are really critical skills that actually can be beneficial long-term and obviously short-term for success. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, and there's always that hope, oh, I want to get into that one school, right? And I'm sure you get asked this all the time, and I'm going to be one of those that asks, of the focus that you give those students. What is that one thing that you encourage them to do so that they can really get into the school that they want to?
Yeah. Well, the big thing we talk a lot about is this concept of having a balanced list of schools and, you know, thinking a little bit about the fact that there are tons of great options in our country. So one of the things I would say for students is thinking a little bit about, if there's 4,000 schools in America and you're only applying to 7 or 10, you know, you're way more selective than any of the most selective schools in the country. You're eliminating 99.9% of places. So in doing that, any place you apply, I think, should be your top choice or should be your first choice. So getting rid of that idea of a dream school or a top choice, like changing your language to say, if I've cut it down to 5, 7, 9, whatever your number is, these are all my top choices. And I really encourage parents here, again, once a kid gets into any school, there is a celebration that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, there needs to be a special dinner or buying something or just like looking back on all it took to get that opportunity. And I think if students can let go of, again, that phrase or that term, that mindset of there's only one place, that I think is something that parents can really help with, is providing that perspective, helping them see all these friends that they know or colleagues that they have that went lots of different places. Because when kids get hung up on that one spot, if it's an unrealistic or a stretch place, then it can set them up for disappointment. But if you can give them perspective of, man, all these are great options, and no matter how this ends up, you are going to really be in a good, good position. That is freeing for students.
And I bet that then the application to that of a school that's maybe fairly easy to get into, right? Like, you know, whether it's a community college or a state university that, that has a very open admission process. Is your advice similar?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if a kid has looked at this and determined, like, here's my goals, this is what matters to me, here are some of my values and the things that line up, and I've found a school where I'm a great fit for that academically, and there's no doubt that I'm getting in, hey, that's an awesome situation to be in. And I really think every student should be able to find at least one or maybe even two places to include in the places they apply to that fit into that category. They match up perfectly, you know, with what a student wants, but their selectivity, you know, has variation. They're not all highly selected. They've got to come a nice cross section. And I think here again, this is like a parent's job, really, is to coach towards that balanced list that's going to give students options. I mean, as parents, again, like ultimately that's what we want for our kids, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if we were to say, what do we all want long-term? Like, we want them to have choices and options. And that's very true in the college admission experience as well.
Yeah. You know, your time at Georgia Tech, what has it taught you about the admission process and maybe that you hadn't realized before?
Yeah. I'd say probably the biggest thing is that college admission really comes down to two things, supply and demand.
Okay.
So in my time here, you know, when I first got here, we were admitting basically two out of every three students because of the number of seats we had available and the number of students applying. And last year we admitted 18% of students, again, based on the number of seats available and the number of students applying. And that's true no matter what school you're talking about. If you're talking about, you know, BYU, if you are talking about Georgetown, if you're talking about University of Maryland or Georgia Tech, it all comes down to supply and demand. That would be one thing. And then the second would be institutional priorities. You know, what is that school all about? And kids get confused by this because when they receive this stuff in the mail, it all looks the same. I mean, they seem to be the same, right? Like three kids of different ethnicities under a tree together with a professor or the football team winning.
Everyone's
like
so
the same
happy.
Thing.
And they,
so happy. Yeah. But really, they are really different. They have different missions. They have different, you know, things they're trying to accomplish, right? And so that drives a lot of admission decisions. And I think this is really important because, you know, students can take decisions really personally. And that's not how they're made. It feels that way, but that's not how they're made. I mean, Georgia Tech's a good example. We, you know, we bring in about 40% of our students from out of state. And so the admit rate is really low. Well, a kid who applies and is not admitted, you know, from, you know, Nebraska or something, that is not about, you know, our prediction of their future success or what we think about what they've accomplished to this point. A lot of that does come down, again, to supply and demand and some of those institutional priorities that drive admission decisions. And here again, I think this is where parents can really help students.
Yeah, to give them that perspective.
Really important.
Be realistic about it. Well, I appreciate you sharing those tidbits of what you've learned and you would know as the Director of Undergraduate Admission at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, Georgia. Thank you so much for your time, Rick.
Oh, thanks, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
You bet. And Rick Clark is also the co-author of the book, The Truth About College Admission. And you can find his blog at admission.gatech.edu/blog or follow him on Twitter at Clark2College, and it's the number 2. Now, coming up in about 2 minutes, the benefits of celebrating wins for us individually and for our families.
You are listening to The Lisa Show.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. You know, last night, it was all a buzz in my home.
Okay.
My son is in a musical, and it's double cast. So one cast will perform one night, and his cast will perform this tonight. So he was going to support the other cast.
Opening night for the other cast.
Opening night, and it's his opening night tonight. And you can tell he's really excited, and I think, isn't it fun to think at a time when either it's your kids or your spouse or your best friend or whoever it is, when you can feel how excited they are, mm-hmm. it gets you excited.
For sure.
And so I was thinking, oh, it's his opening night. What I should do something. You know, if it were, you know, I hate to say that it's, because it's kind of sexist, like, oh, I should get a bouquet of flowers, you know, and I thought, well, he's a guy, will he care? And I just thought, well, don't say that. Yeah, of course, everybody likes to get something, you know. And then I thought, well, maybe I should write him a card or do something. And it made me remember that, like, when I had a win, you know, was celebrating something exciting, like, you know, I got into college or I made the performing group that mm-hmm. I had auditioned for. My mom would like make a little sign, you know, with mm-hmm. some construction paper and a marker. And she's an artist, so it always looked like pretty yeah. professional, with like some streamers, even if it was just, you know, over the door in the kitchen or something like that, to make a big deal about it. Or we would say, we got to go out to dinner. We got to celebrate. You know what? Get your coat. We're going to go celebrate.
What? What is this?
And, you know,
this?
And that created such a buzz and excitement, even if I felt like a little sheepish about it. Or sure. like, well, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, I don't know, whatever. But it was like, hey, let's celebrate. Let's mark this time. And so as I was thinking about ideas of how to celebrate my son and really this culmination of a lot of time and hard work.
Sure.
And
being vulnerable
stress,
on the stage.
Yeah. And to even just to audition, let mm-hmm. alone, you know, sing in front of people and the time involved. And as I was thinking, you know, this should be marked for some celebration. It had me take a little bit of a step back because oftentimes modern parents, and we feel this right now, are criticized for celebrating too much.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Everything. Got out of bed. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. Woo! Woo!
Everybody gets a trophy right. for Little League, even if you right. don't do anything. And so I didn't. It's like it stopped me yesterday, and I thought, oh, I have this itching in the back of my head. So which one do I believe in? Mm. Like, if I'm being intentional and I'm like, how do I want to be? It'll come to no surprise. I want to celebrate.
Of course. Of course.
You know, and I have been accused by my children and others of being a little bit too excited. Just as a general baseline. And so imagine if there's something to celebrate. I get really excited. Like, I realize that sometimes I'll be like, oh, you got to be on that math. You studied so hard for that math test. That's awesome. Like, oh. And they'll be like, settle down.
Mom, I have another
settle
test next week
down.
If we keep this up.
It's not, you know, so for a lot of reasons, some of us may feel hesitant to celebrate mm-hmm. wins, both mm-hmm. big and small. But there is actual research that says that when we do this, not only is it a better, more fun way to live, mm-hmm. but it does help you to move forward with more confidence, to make more goals, to feel more successful, to think more positive, and it changes the way that you view the world. And so I not only will celebrate the big wins or the small wins with my kids, I think I'm going to lean into it a little bit harder.
Okay. Okay.
Now you're looking at me a little bit hesitantly, like, well, what does that mean?
I guess the question on my mind is like, how are you going to
right.
do that,
okay.
right? Because I think if you're like balloons and streamers
yeah,
and
every
hey,
day.
You got that B on that test and you're leaning more into it or whatever, mm-hmm. like at some point, I think that you and your children go, Mom, we have 10 construction paper things. Can we do no. a whiteboard?
Yes. And as someone who has been, again, accused of being a little bit excited, please mm-hmm. take that 10 down to like a 5
yeah, yeah.
where you can live. So if you want to have a little bit more motivation, if you're thinking to yourself, you know, life just seems meh. Mm-hmm. I have these goals, but I don't know if I'm making any progress. If you feel like in that kind of just general stuck or rut, mm-hmm. try celebrating a little bit of your wins. And I'm going to give some advice.
I'm ready.
Okay, so are you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is a small win? Well, that's going to vary from person to person. But in your mind, if you're like, you know, I want to read more, or I want to start an exercise routine, or I want to, you know, get out of bed and make my bed every morning. Like, if you, it can be very small of these things that I just want to hold myself accountable and just get a little bit better. Like, 1%. Like, it's not this huge goal. That should be celebrated after you've done that with some sort of reward, right? Just take time to notice. I said I was going to read 10 pages of this book every night, and I've done it for a week. Like, good for me.
Yeah.
Like, because this is going to accumulate over time, and I'm going to get more and more knowledge, and I'm going to, you know, reach my goals. So even if it's just like a page, like these kinds of wins, you get to define it. You get to be in control. It's not one more thing to feel guilty about.
Good. Because I don't need one more thing to feel guilty about.
Well, and also we need to get excited. You know, a lot of kids get excited about everything.
Yep.
Like, look, I found this rock.
Yeah.
You know, they get excited about a rock or a cool stick they found. And as adults, we get like stodgy. We lose that.
Mm-hmm.
This is a way to mentally get back to a little bit more of that excitement. This will come to no surprise. My family and I encourage each other this. So like, I'll talk to my sister Gina and I'll be like, she'll say, how's it going? I go, you know what happened? I did all the laundry, folded it, and put it away.
Well, yeah.
Exactly.
Yes.
And see, she responds just like that. Like, yeah, you did, because you're a rock star.
Oh, nice.
I don't even need to tell her, like, please celebrate this win for me.
No, she's there.
She's already there. She meets me at an 11 every time. And so why can't we do that for each other and for ourselves? Like, at the end of the day, instead of thinking of all the things you didn't do, why not make that list of all the things you did do, cross it off, hold it up and say, yeah, you did.
Okay, let me practice this. Let me practice this. Hang on.
I know.
Hang on.
I'm not kidding.
No, I'm serious.
Yeah.
Let me practically apply what you're saying right now. So I'm looking around. All right. Hey, I put on a clean T-shirt today.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
Yeah, you did. It's clean.
Yep.
Yeah.
It wasn't folded, but it was clean.
Doesn't matter. It's not even wrinkly.
Thank you.
Things like it does increase your base level of happiness.
Hmm.
Okay. So that this goes into the next thing is that you have to communicate it. Like, you have to either say it out loud to yourself or to other people, right? To verbalize it to someone else. Then everybody wins. Somebody else is going to be, like my sister Gina, is going to be excited for me. She's like, yeah, you did. And you know what I did? Because that's what usually happens in the conversation. Mm-hmm. Then they think of a small win and they want to share it with you because you've opened the door saying, this is our conversation. You know what I did? I put dinner in the crock pot. It's all ready to go, and it's going to be ready when I get home.
Yeah.
Done ahead of time. Mm. Like, wow. Like, you thought about it. You've already got dinner done, and it's like lunchtime. Like, way to go. Celebrating those small wins is contagious.
Okay.
Okay. So another part, like, to overall get out of that kind of rut and celebrate it is to make it a practice every day. Now, some people write in a gratitude journal at the end of the day, mm-hmm. and that could celebrate your small wins. Some people just say it out loud. But if that is your mind frame, if that is your default, it's going to make your life just a little bit happier, because instead of focusing on the negative, you are literally rewiring your brain to look for things that you are doing right. And just think how that will change your inner dialogue, how you live.
I'm thinking now about posting every day on social media my small wins. Do you think
that counts? Actually, that's not a bad idea, you know, because so many times we're so hard on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we see when we go on social media just what a lack there is.
Mm-hmm.
And I love going during a time of gratitude,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's Thanksgiving or sometimes people do this at the new year or when they're in a rut, they're like, listen, I'm trying to change stuff and I'm going to just say good things, things that I am grateful for. And it does make a difference in your everyday happiness. You know, there's a TikTok video that's trending right now online, and I've seen a few people post it where this woman is like, do you guys want to know something amazing? I turn on this faucet and water comes out. I have a flushing toilet. I have a refrigerator that keeps my food cold, that's in here, that helps me, like, just do all those everyday things. And at first you're like, oh, ha ha, very funny, like, how dumb. But then you take a step back and say, oh yeah, these are things that we take for granted.
For sure.
This is a small win.
Yeah.
Modern plumbing.
Yes.
Small win. It's working. Well, and part of this too is living in the present. Like if you're someone, and I struggle with this, just full honesty, of like not living in the past, not freaking out about the future, but you just living in the present.
I love that the option was you could have said living in the past or, you know, focusing on the future or living in the future, that it's freaking out about the future. Because, yeah,
that's how
I dwell too sometimes.
And I'm the happiest when I'm focusing and living in the present moment. I'm not the only one that is.
No,
like,
no.
You read any sort of meditation book or, like, talk to any counselor or therapist, sure, or whatever they're going to tell you. You know, you got to let go and just live in the moment.
Yep.
It's easier said than done for people like me who's zing. My brain just keeps going, but what about?
And then
may I make a comment?
And then you.
Exactly. So day to day, it adds up, right? Just like if you're going to read 10 pages every day of a book, it'll add up. Just like if you're just going to lift weights for 10 minutes a day, it adds up. Like,
yeah, it matters.
Little,
it makes a difference.
Little
it builds.
Build. And the best part, and I know that this is the part that you love about celebrating small wins and the value that they have, not just for ourselves as individuals, but for like our family and our family culture and your friend culture, is that you get to reward yourself and you get to decide what it is.
Yeah.
Any small pleasure. Denying yourself
you
of a small
bet.
Pleasure. A nap, dish of ice cream.
Playing music real loud and dancing around in the kitchen.
Watching your favorite show.
Yep. Going out on your porch and saying, I am wearing a clean shirt. Could be a way that you could celebrate that.
All those things that to rewarding yourself. And it also helps that you don't add pressure on yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it helps with deadlines, because instead of like, I got to hurry up and do this one big thing. If you're just doing it little by little every day and celebrating that, then you're saying, no, I'm making progress to this and it will get done.
Especially for those big things, right? Like if it's little by little, you know that it is, in fact, a big thing. Like if you're moving or, you know, something like that, there's a lot of parts and pieces that you can break that down. And so rather than it feeling like it's this big insurmountable task that you have to do, it can be like, oh, yeah, I packed a box. That's a win.
Yeah.
I packed five boxes.
That is a win.
Yep.
Like today, of all the things that I can do, I did these things.
Yep.
You know, it is a mindset thing. And this is something that I'm really consciously trying to do, because so I am really hard on myself as far as like, oh, it's the end of the day. And you know what? I didn't get this done. I didn't do that. Like even just last night, I was like going to go on a run and then I was like, oh, I got to do this. I got to do that. Like I just went from thing that I had to do to had to do. And I felt guilty, right? And so then at the end of the day, I thought, I don't like to feel this way. So I'll just, you know, do a short little workout or something like that, just because it helps me so much mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a little workout. And instead of being like, good for me, I did it, I was like, but I didn't go on that run that I said I was going to do. So celebrating those small wins, I kind of stopped myself and thought, yeah, but look at like, I went to the bank, I cleaned out my car, I went grocery shopping, all the things that I did accomplish. And try to really like feel them instead of just hyper focusing on the one thing that I didn't get to.
Good for you.
So, but it's hard. It's a mental game, right?
Yeah, for
celebrating
sure.
those small wins.
I don't want to derail the conversation, but I do have a question about celebrating the small wins from something that you brought up. So I don't want to. So with your son now going into opening night tonight, and you sort of brought up the idea of like typically for women, again, not a sexist or misogynistic thing, but women would get flowers for opening night. Have you decided on maybe what
gonna
you might
get? Yeah, I'm going to get flowers.
Good, because you know what I was
going to
say?
I'm going to.
I didn't want to jade you. One of the coolest things that I
it's
ever
cool.
got.
Everyone
this
likes
is
to get flowers.
A couple of decades ago on an opening night, there was a girl that I was dating who sent me flowers to the theater
that was so cool.
And I sort of looked around and I was like, these must be for someone else. And they're like, no, look. And the card there, and it was
hey,
you know, I know you've worked really hard for this thing, and you know, can't wait to be able to see you perform. And it was one of the coolest things I ever got. And then subsequently, I of course took pictures and said, "Look, I got flowers." Shared them on social media. It was a big win of a small win, a kind of a minor thing, but pretty awesome.
So what I love about that is that kind of culture that I want to create. I want to be Like, when have you ever received a, hey, that was really cool that you did that thing,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a card, a note, flowers, or just a verbal affirmation, and ever thought and never not liked it?
Yeah.
So why don't we do it more for mm-hmm. other people? Like, why am I not sending flowers to other people mm-hmm. more often? Honestly,
yep.
like, hey, I know you worked really hard on this thing. Thank you. You know, like, this is so cool. Congratulations.
Right.
Like, or I saw that you accomplished this, even if it's a small thing, like, way to go.
And I think maybe some would say, okay, well, flowers cost money, Lisa and Richie, so that's why I can't send flowers a bunch. But think about people that you interact with mm-hmm. at work mm-hmm. or if you do a volunteer
yeah.
thing in your community or something like that. Even if you just took a moment and wrote a card and said, you know what?
Yes.
I know you work really hard mm-hmm. at this.
Celebrate the small ones.
And I just want you to know that I notice. That is noticed by me. Doesn't even have to be that. Could be a text message. Can be an email.
Yeah.
I think there's sometimes a little bit of a touch or a uniqueness when you do something that's physical and maybe a little
too.
Bit above
or
and
in
beyond.
Person.
But still, it's celebrating
mm-hmm.
a win. Even if you're just maybe you're doing a radio show with a great friend of yours and you say something like, you know what? This celebrating the small wins, Lisa,
yeah.
I have really enjoyed this. And
thank
I'm glad
you.
That you brought this to the show today.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Thanks. And this is something that you have beautifully illustrated, which is it's always better like in a group, in a team, because then it makes you feel more connected to other people and it creates this culture and the signal that you as an individual are a safe place
mm-hmm.
to have other people be like, hey, you know what I did? You know what I mean? And you can encourage each other. And we all need a little bit more encouragement,
yeah.
right? And so if you're looking to create a little bit more confidence as a team at work or cohesiveness in a family, celebrating those kinds of wins is so important. And especially in a relationship.
For sure.
You know, whether it's a friendship or a romantic partnership, like being able to celebrate the small wins can create that kind of connection and also propel you forward to make even more small goals.
So dare we offer this challenge as you interact within your day today? You're giggling, but
this is where it's gone because I'm really going to do this.
I think that it's worthwhile, and we would like to challenge you to do this. Find an opportunity to celebrate a small or large win. Now, maybe it's one within yourself or maybe it's one with
yeah,
whom you interact.
Matter.
Doesn't matter. Don't put limits. Don't already put a boundary to this thing that we're challenging you to, but take this opportunity today. Find something that you can celebrate, yours or within somebody else, and take a moment to celebrate it for whatever that means. If it's
mm-hmm.
flowers, great. If it's a card, awesome. If it's an email or a text, also cool, but do it and see how you feel.
And if you feel sheepish about it, start with yourself. Start with celebrating some small wins. You'll be surprised how you want to verbalize it, live in the moment, and have it spread.
Coming up in about 6 minutes, how the type of music you let your kids listen to affects their development.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show.
You're listening to Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. It's The Lisa Show.
How much does it take for someone to push you over the edge? Well, coming up in about 20 minutes, we're talking about how to temper our temper.
And you've probably been waiting for Wicked, the movie musical. Well, they have finally cast Elphaba and Glinda, and I will tell
wow.
you who it is coming up in your buzz. And when we think about music, we think about how it can be such a powerful thing. It has the ability to not only affect our mood, but also our emotions. And more importantly, it affects child brain development, right? We've probably heard that before. And certainly there is a myriad of products and techniques that we have heard about either anecdotally or that we've experienced and tried with our own children. You've maybe wondered if the type of music that your child listens to is important, and if that is the case, if there is a certain type that improves or increases brain development, well, then what type is it? First of all, then what type is it, first of all? And why in particular is it that type of music? Well, joining us today is Dr. Anita Collins, who is an award-winning educator, a TEDx speaker, and writer who specializes in brain development and music learning. Let me ask you, is it a particular type of music that we should be allowing our young children to listen to for increased brain development?
There isn't one type of music that is. There's not one magic genre, which is like, this is better than this one. It's very much about understanding that sound, or music is sound, and sound is incredibly important to the brain. And it's incredibly important because our hearing and our sound processing is our largest information gathering sense. So it needs lots of food. And so for that same sort of reason, if we think about it like food, we wouldn't want our children just to eat McDonald's, for example, mm-hmm. or to eat junk food, or to really stick to just one kind of food. We'd actually really, really want them to have a variety of food. Now, music and music listening's a little bit the same. We wouldn't want them to have just one type of music, because that's just like having McDonald's every day. They actually need a variety of sounds, a variety of types of music, and a variety of different places where they hear that music. Sometimes they need to hear it recorded. Hearing it live is a whole different experience for the brain. Mm-hmm. And hearing it sort of incidentally, like, oh, there's music in the background, versus sitting actively and listening to a piece of music being performed. So it's about variety. Now, that can be really tricky with kids. Particularly teenagers, they're creating their identity through the music that they're choosing to listen to. It's, mm-hmm. it's actually really important to start early and to get kids to listening, just getting used to listening to lots and lots of different pieces of music, and actually listening, not just having it in the background, but sort of commenting about, how does this make you feel? What does this remind you of? And it gets them interested in lots of different kinds of music, and hopefully that will continue through teenagehood and into their adult life.
Well, this strikes me as something that I've never heard before, because, like, the products that especially the young toddler, or maybe even in utero, we think of, like, baby Mozart. We don't often see baby Tupac or, you know, baby Snoop Dogg as an availability for kids. Is there a reason why the mentality is that it should be that classical or orchestral music for the really young kids?
Yeah, it's not a mentality necessarily, but it's about the amount of musical information that's in the song. Now, that's not to say, that's getting totally away from the idea that it's good and bad music. Mm-hmm. That's a judgment we make. There is different amounts of musical information in a song, and it has to do with everything from how long the song is, how much variety is in it, how many different types of sounds are in it. And if, again, if we think of that as variety on a plate, it's like having lots of different vegetables, lots of different proteins, a couple of different carbohydrates. It's a really rich, amazing meal. Whereas some songs are shorter, they don't have a lot of variety in them, they're really predictable, which our brain kind of likes, and then it goes, I'm a bit bored now. and that's a smaller plate with less variety on it. So the classical music has that inherent in it. It's usually longer, so it's not the 3 or 4 minute pop song. It usually has far more variety. There's a lot more instrumental sounds in there because it's usually played by an orchestra. So it's sort of that tendency to go towards the more complex music. Interestingly, I found that fascinating when I looked at it and went, well, that's one type of music, and that's one type of meal for the brain. Mm-hmm. But it's actually really important to remember that babies, right from even in utero in the last 3 months, they actually need music, or the brain uses music that has a steady beat in it. Hmm. And the reason it does that is because it uses the beat to talk to the rest of its body, to teach the body how to move. So this whole idea, we see little toddlers who are in the supermarket hearing the music and they're bouncing around, mm-hmm. and we think it's really cute, and it is cute. But it actually is also, we're seeing a cognitive activity at play. We're seeing them use their auditory processing to talk to the rest of their body, to say, this is how I move with intention. This is how I talk to the rest of my body, and we connect them together. So when it comes to variety, they absolutely need the complex, interesting classical music, but they do need music that's got a really steady beat in it to sort of enable that cognitive process. And we know the sooner they get their sort of body's connected, the sooner they start, you know, jumping onto all those new learnings that happen, particularly before the age of five.
Dr. Anita Collins is my guest as we talk about music and child development. And I love this picture that you have painted about a plate and how, you know, eating all of the same thing, that doesn't give our body the nutrition. But what I also love about that as an example is so many times as parents, we think, oh, well, I didn't do that when they were in utero. I didn't do that when they were a toddler. And so now any sort of development that I could ever, you know, influence on my child, it's too late. Whereas if we think of it like food, it's like, no, your kid has to eat at six, just like they have to eat at 10. Their needs may be different, but they're always needing to eat and have that experience in order to be able to grow.
Exactly. And a lot of the time with food, often I keep going back to it because it's a really good way to explain it. If we put a plate of food in front of a young child and say, eat all of this, they'll go, great, I'm hungry, fantastic, and I love all the food on the plate. But sometimes they're like, no, I don't like those things over there, but I'll eat this one over here. And music's a bit the same. Sort of sometimes you can put on some music and say, listen to this, and they might be in the right mood and excited and music that's really resonating with them at the time. But they also need just music in their environment. So it's really important that kids understand the music that you like as a parent and music that you find really interesting and engages you, and actually role modeling that and not being afraid to dance around the kitchen to your favorite song and all those sorts of things that sort of just bring music into the world all the time and being aware of that. But also even going outside and listening to sounds and going, what's the music of nature? What's the music of the city? What's the music, you know, when we're in another environment, and how does that make you feel, and what things do you notice? That's all music to the brain.
What I additionally love about it is the connection that occurs when a parent shares the music that they love or the music of their childhood with their child, because you're not just getting the music, you're not just getting the sounds, you're getting the stories and the culture and the history that parent can impart by sharing the music. Because music isn't just I listened to the song and isn't this a great song? It was, I remember I was at a concert and I remember the man or the woman that I was with. And I remember, you know, all of these things around it as we share it with our kids. That's just another level, I guess I'm wondering, of the development that comes through sharing music.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll even add another level to that. We now understand that the brain, babies understand who their tribe is, who their carers are, who their family is, who to trust and who not to trust. The very first way they do it is through song. So they actually hear, when we sing to our babies, that's actually a connection. And we have heaps of research on it now, that the baby then goes, this is who I can trust and this is who looks after me. And then by the same token, if someone else sings and they don't know the voice, the vocal signature, it's like, I don't know you, so therefore I don't know if I should trust you. So the sharing of music in the household, and this is beyond babyhood, this is all the way through, you know, dancing around the kitchen, singing, even if it's whistling, all those sorts of things is actually a way of remaining and reinforcing that connection within family. And it's very, at a very physiological level, it's very deep inside of us to say, we are family, and we express that because we're sharing a musical experience. So it has this even deeper level than that, that is very, very primal.
When you share with others, hey, this is how valuable music can be for your kids, how do we best do it? So hearing this, certainly I think everyone agrees on a connectivity level, on, you know, the science level, on just a very base level. Yes, music is great, but is it as regimented as, you know, 15 minutes of rap followed by 15 minutes of classic rock? And then coming up this afternoon, you'll get your diet of classical music and then we'll do some jazz, or is there another way we can access this?
I think we have to always remember we're human, and particularly children are on the outside far more up and down than we are as adults. So regimenting it doesn't work. It needs to be infused into the daily life. And there's a big difference between listening to music and learning music. They're very different processes in the brain, and they have very different sort of cognitive results. They share some for sure, but they are very different. So the listening part needs to be that there's a couple of things, that music is accessible, which means it can be put on at any time. I mean, we live in this wonderful time where we can, you know, speak to a device and it can play a piece of music. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to have all our records and your sort of CDs and things like that. So, you know, being able to ask a device to say, play the most popular song from, you know, this particular year, or play the most popular piece by Beethoven or something like that, actually makes it a little bit of an adventure. Mm-hmm. And I think infusing that, we at home have Sunday night, you know, dinners, and during dinner, each member of the family is allowed to pick a song, and we just ask and say, can you play this song? And then it goes to the next person. So there's music on in the background. It's not very loud, but it's just our opportunity to adventure into different kinds of music. And then we get to share those stories as well. And then we share a meal. So it's that very much that sharing and coming together. And I think in our times, it's a really important thing to do to maintain those sort of opportunities where we come together as families.
You've authored the book, The Music Advantage. Give me an idea. Is it a spelling out of kind of the sampling that we've talked about, or what can people gain from that book?
So The Music Advantage is a book for parents and teachers and even senior students as well, that tries to talk about it. Well, I talk about all of the research, but I do it very much. I'm a music teacher myself. Mm-hmm. And I do it from the point of story. So just like the analogy of a meal, I try and pick stories that sort of explain what we might see on the outside of a child and behavior and things I might say. And then I delve into the science that is behind what's happening inside their brain. So it's really, really great for parents to help them understand the journey that their child is going through when they're learning music in particular. But it's also really, really good if your child isn't learning music. It helps you to, once they start, and it might, you know, inspire you to help them to get going. But as they go through to notice the things that are happening for them, when they're frustrated, that's not a bad thing. That's actually a wonderful thing. But how do you help as a parent to go, okay, you are frustrated, but this is a really important like hurdle. And when you get over this hurdle, amazing things are on the other side. And then it helps to explain the brain science as well. So hopefully it helps parenting may become a little bit easier, but also gets us past. We've got some really interesting and limiting myths about learning music and about why children should do it. We have these ideas that kids should only learn if they're interested and only learn if they're going to be the very best of the best of the best. Mm. And this research shows us that that's definitely not what should happen. It should be every child who's learning, not so they become a professional musician, but very much so that they can develop the cognitive foundations for really good learning, which will benefit them through the rest of their lives and they can take into the rest of their lives. So it's a way of starting that journey and to help people get into the really tricky science through a very simple way of communicating as humans, which is through stories.
I absolutely love all of that. And I just think it can be so impactful in so many different ways. And I love that you spoke into the piece that, especially with learning music, that our kids don't have to be the next great music producer or the next Mozart or anything like that, that there is value in just learning about and learning through music. I would be curious, before I let you go, to have a whole conversation and not know what your jam or what your favorite song is or a thing that you're listening to recently. I think that would be a huge miss for us. What's something that you're listening to that you're like, I like this. This is what I'm enjoying.
I think I'd have to say something that's on very high rotation in our house is Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is I love musical theatre, but I love it because it's many different art forms fusing together. And I also have been a musical director of several of them, and I understand how complex they are. But I think for me at the moment, historically, it's helping to teach my daughter, and we're in Australia, but it's helping her to understand the journey of a country that is not our own into sort of where it is today and the foundations. And she's able to watch the news and hear things about the US and then go, oh, that was back from Hamilton. She's like, you know, she hears names like Lafayette and she goes, oh, I have heard that before. So it's teaching all of those things. For me, musically, it's an incredibly new take, an innovative take on a quite established sort of form of music. And it's incredibly musically clever. I think when you're musically trained, I sit and I look at every single bit and understand the innovation, but also how clever it is underneath. And I think that's the thing that keeps bringing me back to it, is there's a lot of musical information in there for me, and it keeps me really, really engaged. So that's on high rotation, and we have our favorites, but every once in a while we pick the ones we haven't heard before and we learn something new.
Dr. Anita Collins is an award-winning educator and author who studies music and how it affects child development. If you want to learn more about her work and about her and also about her book, you can go to anitacollinsmusic.com, or you can find her book, The Music Advantage, directly there on the website or on Amazon or wherever you find great books. And we appreciate your time, Dr. Collins.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up in about 6 minutes, we're going to find out why we can be so easy to aggravate and how we can remedy that.
If you love the musical Wicked, they have announced who will be playing Elphaba and Glinda as the characters on the big screen. Who are they? Well, I'll tell you coming up in your buzz. You are listening to The Lisa Show.
Listening to The Lisa Show. Are you looking for fun ways to enjoy the weekend? Coming up in 20 minutes, keep listening for an update on events going around the country this week. Wonderful things to eat and to watch. But first, it's time for The Buzz with Richie T.
That's right. It is three things that are trending online and likely to be a conversation, whether it be in your home place or your workplace, the public places where you find yourself today. People will likely be talking about these things. The NBA is launching an investigation into the Phoenix Suns and the conduct of majority owner Robert Sarver, the league said yesterday. The league announcement that it will use the law firm Watchell Lipton to conduct the investigation comes in the wake of ESPN publishing an investigative story based on interviews with more than 70 current and former Suns employees who described as sometimes toxic and hostile workplace of racism and sexism during Sarver's 17-year tenure in Phoenix. So a lot of people talking about that. Also, if you want something to just, you know, maybe kick back a little bit, maybe laugh a little bit, if you love Adele, you certainly have heard her new song, Easy On Me. I've never seen this before, but you can find it trending over on YouTube, the official bloopers version of that video. And my favorite part, if you've seen the Easy On Me music video, there's a part where she slides the tape into the tape deck. And in the music video, obviously, it just goes in and then she's able to listen to the song. However, in the bloopers, that tape becomes her worst nemesis as she tries to get that to work out. And then finally this, I couldn't believe this when I saw this, but they have finally cast who will be playing Glinda and Elphaba in the movie version of the musical Wicked. Now, if you haven't heard about this yet, they have delayed this for a little bit. It'll be actually directed by John Chu, who directed In the Heights by Lin-Manuel Miranda that came out earlier this year. So, great director behind this, but a lot of people talking about who's playing Elphaba and Glinda. Well, Elphaba, that will be played by Cynthia Erivo. And Glinda will be played by Ariana Grande. And people all over the internet have feelings about that for sure. You can weigh in on it as well. You could actually see Ariana Grande at the 15th anniversary of Wicked the Musical singing The Wizard and I. So, I mean, she does great, but is that who you sort of envisioned within the role? That's what the internet wants to know, apparently. And that's why everyone is weighing in on that. It's trending online, and that is your buzz.
What sets you off? Is it that person who cuts you off on the way home? Or is it that sly comment that your coworker always has to make, or a dig? Whose name, if you can't remember somebody's name and they always reintroduce themselves to you. I mean, there's so many different scenarios of things that set people off. There's always something that you think, well, this could ruin my day or change my mood. So how do you manage your temper? How do you avoid getting triggered? Do you think about it ahead of time? Do you try to catch yourself in the moment? Well, we're speaking to Shasheen Shah, executive counselor and author, about how to do just that and live that kind of trigger-free lifestyle. Welcome, Shasheen.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
We use this word triggered a lot, like that triggered me or, you know, is that triggering to you? And I think we use it so much without really understanding what it means. And so I'm wondering, what is your working definition of triggered?
I would say a trigger is, you know, an intense emotional reaction to something that puts us in an emotional state in which our ability to choose an action that is consistent with the outcomes that we want doesn't actually get a fair shake. So it's something where, you know, in a normal, calm environment, we have this ability to kind of assess and see what's happening and be able to then choose an action that's consistent with, you know, how we want to be in the world. When we're triggered, another way it's been described is like we get hijacked, right?
It feels that way. Brain scientists call it.
Yeah, like, you know, our brains get hijacked. Something says something. And it's like, you know, we don't all of a sudden our reaction is we know the words that are coming out of our mouth are not going to land well.
Yeah.
And it's just like falling off a cliff. We do it anyway. And we've all been there.
Yeah, and we've all been there. And I think that sometimes we think, well, we're justified, right? We should be upset if somebody wrongs us. And so what is that line then between where, yes, we're bugged, we have an emotional reaction to something someone said or did, and then our action?
Look, I think that, you know, it just depends on what kind of life you want to live. The people that I work for, the people that, you know, and I look at what my life is about. I mean, there's a lot of people that can go through life just getting triggered all the time. You see them all the time.
Yeah.
Things just sets them off. And like, there he goes again. You know, there's Bob, there's Jane. You know, that's how they live their life. And at some point, you know, along the way, people will kind of say, gosh, you know, there's got to be a better way.
Yeah,
there's got to be something different. You know, I can't keep going through life in this triggered state. And, you know, the net result for some are you get into addiction issues, you get into health issues, you get into just, you know, being alone and by yourself. No one really wants to hang around you after a certain point. They're like,
right.
Okay, all right, you know, like, you know, you're tolerated more than loved, I think, in life when you're that person that's constantly getting triggered.
Okay, so if you are asking yourself that question, what kind of life do you want to live, and you don't want to be triggered so much, how do you respond then and you know, make that better choice in the moment?
Yeah, so, you know, it takes practice and it takes leverage, right? You have to actually see it as an issue. A lot of people will go through life feeling really justified about whatever it might be. Just take the political scene right now, all these hot button topics. People want to be right. And, you know, that's okay. One of my mentors said to me, they're like, Shasheen, listen, I don't ever want you to lose your power of discernment. However, I don't want it to keep getting in the way of you living a life well lived.
Yeah.
And I realized that I just found myself in these places. So, you know, the premise of the book is, you know, how is it that really smart people, you know, how do really smart people end up having these tantrums and take actions and react in certain ways that when you look at them, you're like, how in the world? You're so smart. You're so talented. You've got some of the best education in the world. You run a company. You're a head of the household. You're an entrepreneur. And why is it that when Sally says that, 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 or Bob says that, 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 you lose it? What's going on here? And the book really examines the dynamic of how this part of us, this fear-driven response within us, can actually get in the way of living an outcome-driven life.
How that fear, kind of drives us. That is an interesting point. And I'd love for you to explain a little bit more about what you've discovered about where that fear comes from and how you sort of reroute it.
Yeah. So, look, I work with a lot of executives in my practice.
Okay.
And, you know, and I've spent my life looking around and living in beautiful places around the world and you know, ski resort communities and wealthy communities. And, you know, what I realized was like, how, you know, there's the good life out there. And mm-hmm. and if you see some of these people and you see how they respond and they react, there's just, they seem to be miserable. So the premise was like, well, I think the guy that's winning at the end of the day, the guy that's winning at the end of the day is the person that gets less triggered. So where does that come from? Well, when we started to dig into it, when I started to dig into it, I really underestimated the extent to which my experiences growing up as a child were influencing how I see the world today. And so we all come to the table conditioned with a series and set of experiences that have us respond to certain things in certain ways. So if your dad was a rager and people yell, if you're in a relationship and someone yelling, it's going to trigger you. Tone of voice can trigger you. Certain political beliefs can trigger you. So how we interpret the data that comes in through the filter, our eyes, ears, nose, you know, right? How we see and experience things goes through a filter. And if that filter is filled with a situation or experience that led to some negative result, our response system, our limbic system, is actually wired in that way to respond in a protective way. So that's where it comes from.
Wow. We're talking with Shasheen Shah, an executive consultant for many different businesses, about how we really, I was going to say, like, pivot when someone pushes you over to the edge, right? And temper that temper and avoid getting triggered. And I appreciate you laying out why it is that we do this and why it is part of human nature and why triggers are so different for other people, just depending on so many different factors, upbringing and different socioeconomic relations and different kinds of relationships. Knowing all of that and swirling around, I want to push back just a little bit. I mean, is it ever okay to have an outburst? Is it ever justified or maybe used in the right way?
I think that, first of all, they will happen, period. There's no way to get rid of them. So let's deal with that, right? So that's going to happen. So whether they're justified or not, I would say that, so the way I've broken it down in the book, The Kid and the King, is to basically look at five questions, which I call the emotional mastery process. And the goal is to just see, and to answer your question, is it justified? The question is, what was your outcome in the outburst, right? Was your outcome to protect, defend, justify, explain, you know, you're put on defense, and so you have to react in that way? Well, I would argue in the book that that's the kid-like response in you. That's not the king or the queen with you. That's not that person that's walking through life elegantly. Now, if someone comes up and puts a gun to my head and starts going after you, well, you know, in that case, I would argue that an outburst, a strong reaction, a triggered moment of fear that would like create some violence even would be justified in that case to protect yourself. That's the case. But I think there's a difference between when our physical, like, survivability is at stake versus our emotional survivability is at stake. And I want to deal with the emotional survivability. We're just, when you start looking at your just the happiness, the joy that you're feeling in life, if you're not feeling great, well, there's some part of you that's trying to emotionally survive. So the five questions are simply like, what did you observe? What did you conclude? What emotional reaction came from that conclusion? What action did you take? And did that action move you closer to or farther from your intended outcome? And what I found for myself and for my clients is that I never really thought about having an outcome. I go through life with an expectation. I just expect, well, you know, someone's 10 minutes late to a call. Wow, wait a second. My expectations, I'm upset. What happened? All that happened was the call started 10 minutes late. What did I then conclude? Oh, wow, there's a world that could open up. Something could have happened. They may have been delayed. There might have been another call. Or I can make it mean they disrespect my time. They have no sense. They're disorder. You can come into that conversation with a million conclusions. Yeah. So the idea is for any given circumstance, I've got a world of possibility in terms of what I conclude. However, if I'm not conscious of the fact that my conclusions are based on my particular conditioning and my particular experience in on life or my expectations, well, Then I look at the emotional state that results. And if I'm getting upset, you know, frustrated, angry, or whatever, well, then I have to look back at step two and just say, is that conclusion accurate? Because my action now is to be upset. Well, I don't want to be upset because that's not consistent with what I want to do in this next moment. And so that's where the work is. And if you can just work through those five questions, you will develop mastery over seeing when those triggers are coming and softening the amount of intensity and duration. So how intensely you experience those triggers and for how long can really start to shift. And that's what I take on in the book.
I love it. Very well said. What kind of life do you want to live? Well, Shasheen Shah knows and has written this great book, The Kid and the King, The Hidden Inner Struggle High Achievers Must Conquer to Reignite and Reengage with Life. To learn more from Shasheen, you can visit his website at shasheen.com. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Coming up in about 2 minutes, we're going to share our best tips on how to enjoy the weekend.
You are listening to The Lisa Show. Well, it is the weekend, and as we always do here on The Lisa Show, we like to give you a bunch of suggestions, things that you can probably eat, things that you can probably view, things that you can probably try, and maybe, give you a new point of view as you look and head into your weekend. And we always start with streaming because we know that's where you always start.
It's so true.
Even if you, you're like, oh, we're going to get outside this weekend because maybe one of the last nice weekends. We know you're going to stream something.
You got to kick your feet up.
You're not
and
kidding
relax.
Anybody. You're not
you know, you're
anyone.
Raking leaves or you're baking something
oh,
and cooking.
My back
oh, you got to just sit down for just a second. I wonder what's on TV.
I'm just resting my eyes.
Tell
That's
you.
How
yeah.
it goes after that.
Yep. Absolutely.
Let's start over on Netflix.
There's Manifest, which is passengers on a plane finally landed after several years missing in the air, find that the world's completely changed around them. This is really exciting because you watch the Stone family unravel the mystery that alters their fate. So it's a mystery, but also it's bringing together people. So it's also, what would you call it? Like a drama. A lot of drama.
I've been on those plane flights that feel like years. Yeah. And when you finally touch down, you feel like it's a different world, and you're how long were we up there? Oh, 3 hours?
Got it.
I'm being dramatic.
Cool.
Stranger Things, it's season 4. It's confirmed for 2022. So if you need to get ready
I need to get ready. Yeah, I'm not caught up.
I haven't seen all the seasons.
Okay.
Now's the time to do it, and this weekend, the way to do it. If you don't know, over on Netflix, it's the disappearance of a young boy in a small town in Indiana. It triggers a series of discoveries, including secret experiments, supernatural forces, and one strange little girl.
Over on Hulu is La Brea. It's also over on NBC's Peacock. After a massive sinkhole separates a family in Los Angeles, a father soon realizes what he sees in vision may actually help solve why his family has been separated and how he can get them back together.
And if you haven't seen this, also on Hulu, is The Wonder Years.
This is
the new Wonder Years.
I know. I've heard really good things about this.
Seen through the eyes of 12-year-old Dean, he recounts the memories of growing up at home in Montgomery, Alabama, and the many life-changing moments that he's had along the way. I loved the original Wonder Years. Here's my hesitation so far. I just have been I've been like, I love the original.
Yeah. Oh.
Are we trying to be like the original? Am I going to watch this for those feel-good moments? Because I was at a different place in my life when I watched the original.
Yeah, sure.
So is it going to be the same thing?
There's a lot of anxiety around here.
Go there. I will go there, of course, because like you say, people are saying great things about it. But it's not just as simple as clicking the old TV on and saying, I'm going to do it. Like, there's a lot at stake in my heart.
Okay.
It's over on Hulu. It's The Wonder Years.
Over on Amazon Prime. Now, stay with me here. Judy Justice. Mm-hmm. If you're like, wait, what is this, Marvel character? No. You know, Judge Judy,
How awesome would that be?
I know. Is now rebranded as Judy Justice. It's America's favorite judge. She's back better than ever. Honorable Judge Judy Shenlin returns for another round of courtroom drama, presiding and deciding only as she knows how, delivering what viewers know as Judy Justice.
You know what I love? She reminds me sort of one of the Golden Girls.
Yeah.
And I think that
she would fit into that world 100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like that.
I could watch Judge Judy or Judy Justice or whatever we want. I could watch Judy Shinlin like hours. And in fact, many years of my teenage.
You probably have.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Confessions.
Get that guy. Here we go. Oh, there it is.
I also want to mention over on Apple Plus, because I know you're a huge Tom Hanks fan.
Okay.
That there's a new movie out that's available today, Finch. It's like Castaway meets Short Circuit meets Twister.
Oh, okay.
It's a sci-fi. It's got him in. He's building a robot that talks, and there's a dog. All the things you love, Richie. All the things we all love.
Yeah.
Tornadoes.
I don't know that everyone loves tornadoes. So.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Maybe it's just me. Yeah. I grew up in the Midwest. Building your own robot that becomes your best friend.
Hold on. Does everyone in the Midwest love tornadoes, too?
Well, they're just fascinating. Okay, they're beautiful.
They're what make us unique.
A little bit.
Yeah, okay.
You know, so great special effects.
Okay.
Building your own robot that becomes your best friend.
I love it.
Having a dog that, like, turns his head on the side and goes, at just the right moment.
Okay.
And is there to help him save the world, I guess, or something. I'm not quite sure, but that's available today. That's a great movie.
I haven't done the Apple Plus yet. Apple
Tom,
TV.
Apple TV.
Disney Plus.
Yeah. Listen.
Listen. We want to uncable so that we don't have to pay for so many options.
Wait a second.
If you're looking for a delicious way to spend your weekend, I have already made two soups this fall, and maybe I'll drop into this crock pot potato soup. Mm. Well, I love a crock pot soup.
Yeah.
Because it's the way that my life runs.
Yeah.
I chuck everything into a thing, I leave it, and then come back and go, I hope that's better than the way I left it. It is.
And it is. I love that.
You can find it over at Delish from Mackenzie Gore, a great classic baked potato soup, which, if I'm being honest, if I'm being 100% transparent, and I have no reason not to, I don't know that I have indulged many times in potato soups.
I've done a cream soup.
I've done a lot of, like, stews. But...
Oh, you're missing out then. This was a staple for me growing up. I love it. It's good and hearty. But if you're craving something Italian, you don't want to shell out the extra money for takeout. Try making at home the cheese manicotti from Lena Abraham at Delish. It takes less than an hour. It's easier than you think. Cheese manicotti, it's always worth the wait.
If you want something fresh to add to the holiday table, how about the Thanksgiving spoon salad from Amanda Neal over at the Food Network? It's an ode to all of the fall flavors with pecans, sweet roasted squash, and more goodies tossed together. And true to its name, it's able to be enjoyed by, you guessed it, the spoonful.
Oh, okay.
You're not chasing it around with a fork. That's my one down thing about a salad. I'm like, why? This is more work than a spoon, because you have to poke it, and then if you don't get it right the first time,
really,
you have to poke the salad. Listen.
I think you're overthinking this. Okay.
There are trials that are faced.
I guess
Midwesterners love tornadoes, you can rest assured that there are people that struggle with the salad.
Are you trying to figure out what to make for Thanksgiving? You need to do some trial and run. Check out Food Network's best Thanksgiving recipes from every state. From Alabama's red velvet cake to Florida's deep fried turkey. You should jump over there. Take a look to see what they've got. To see, what your guests, because everybody's guests are going to be different, would want this holiday season.
I love that. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for something to put in your ears, something that will be uplifting, inspiring, educational, you can check out The Lisa Show. It's two folks. They're nice. They're pleasant people.
Yeah.
They have some inside jokes that when you listen for even half a second, you can go, they're like my best friends. You can find The Lisa Show wherever you find podcasts.
Also, Steph, you should know, Josh Clark and Chuck Bryant cover all sorts of topics you should know about, but didn't know you needed to know. I have listened to this podcast for years. It's super interesting.
Cooking Up a Storm with Al Roker. Yeah, that's right. Your favorite weatherman.
Oh.
He's creating a Thanksgiving meal with a different guest every week, complete with a side of personal stories and insights that reveal a recipe's deeper connections to the guest's family and friends. I love that.
And This American Life. Ira Glass hosts this really popular podcast, heard by 2.2 million people. It shares personal stories that go beyond what we know for everyday life. There's always something to connect with.
If you're looking for an event, something that you can get out
out and do if you've heard of U-Sleuth. It's an augmented reality detective game that combines the elements of Clue and Pokemon Go and can be completely done on your own schedule, in your own neighborhood, with your own mobile device.
Oh.
No traveling required. The duration is usually between 90 minutes and 2 hours, and you can find more information about it at usleuth.com. That sounds awesome.
That sounds really cool, and I really also think you should stop everything. This is the highlight of your weekend. It's National Donut Day today.
Mm-hmm.
It's National Donut Day. Pick up your favorite donut. For me, that's a nice buttermilk bar or maybe an old-fashioned.
If you're looking for a book, something that you'd like to read, you see, kids, back before there were, well, I digress, a great book that comes out, The Storyteller by Dave Grohl. That's right, legendary musician known for his work with Foo Fighters and Nirvana. It's talking about his life as only he can, walking through life while living out the crazy dreams, written by Dave Grohl. It's called The Storyteller.
And also Talking to Strangers by Malcolm Gladwell. He obviously is very famous, written a lot of books, offers a powerful examination of our interaction with strangers and why they often go wrong.
And Stanley Tucci.
National treasure.
The book called Taste by Stanley Tucci. Stanley Tucci. The well-known actor and food-obsessed Tucci shares his memories of life inside and outside the kitchen, from spending nights around the kitchen table in his hometown of Westchester, New York, to making meals for a multitude of children with his wife. Every story is sure to be delicious as the last. So after all of those suggestions of things that we can do this weekend, the question remains, is it a candy hangover weekend or what are you doing?
Well, I'm glad that you asked because I am in full holiday spirit mode.
Okay.
And I'm hosting a Friendsgiving.
Now I'm a fan of Friendsgiving, and maybe if people don't know or are unfamiliar with the term, briefly, Friendsgiving is.
Yeah, you bet. Like, so we have a Thanksgiving on Thanksgiving Day, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes this is like an opportunity to invite friends over that you love, friends who are like family, and do sort of a Thanksgiving pre-run. So maybe there's a couple of pie recipes that I want to try out.
Okay.
Also, sometimes it's just a good excuse to bring people together that maybe I love but don't see very often,
mm-hmm.
and kind of say, not kind of, but explicitly say, I love you, I'm grateful for you, and I wanted to make a nice meal for you.
I like that you're doing it this early. I initially was going to give you a hard time. I'm like, really,
no,
really chomping the
that's
bit.
That's the genius part of it, is doing it this early.
Because then they don't have to compete with something else, because some people, maybe they don't get together with their family on the actual Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
They get together the Sunday before or whatever. You're not competing with that because it's a couple weeks out. I appreciate that. Now, let me ask you some questions around your Friendsgiving, rather. Did you make everyone RSVP?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, okay.
I gotta know how many
people. Did you
do
paper invitations?
No.
Okay, so that's a thing I would sort of. Okay, you don't.
I don't. But I realize that some people do, and they love that kind of thing. For me, I think it's unnecessary in our digital age.
Did you make food assignments?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so are you, as you alluded to, your pie pre-run,
well,
are you in fact the pie person?
I feel like there should be one full pie for every adult at the meal.
Yeah.
A full pie.
Mm-hmm.
Because leftover pie is one of the best parts of Thanksgiving. And so why not have that at the beginning of the month and then again for the real Thanksgiving?
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the month.
Mm-hmm. Doctors might disagree with you, but everyone else,
sure,
I think, would be on board.
They're not invited.
Yeah, we've invited. No. who, when you do a Friendsgiving, is there a certain element of trust as to whom you entrust the obligation of the turkey? I spoke with my brother because he sort of hosts the family Thanksgiving.
Sure.
He recently has purchased a smoker. And he normally is a turkey in a bag in the oven kind of guy. And I said, now with this smoker, are you going to smoke your Thanksgiving turkey? He said, no way. I said, that you dismissed that awfully quickly. He's like, turkey's biggest responsibility about Thanksgiving dinner. You blow the turkey, you blow the party.
Yeah,
I said, okay. So with
but
your Friendsgiving, are you in charge of your turkey?
Yeah, because if you are hosting, you want it warm, you want it there, it needs to rest before you carve it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are lots of steps, even though roasting a turkey is really not that hard, but it has steps.
Yeah.
And it requires time and forethought, you know, like, and so I want to take care of that. And make sure that the items that, like, really need preparation and special TLC are done in my kitchen.
You're not taking on too much then, because now
probably.
I've heard pies and now and now turkey too. Are you letting?
Well,
are you,
here,
are you clinging to other
first,
things too?
This isn't my first rodeo.
I'm worried about you.
I know,
because the
I
weekend should
that.
Be a time of rest, and then when we come
well,
back,
well, I
next
do
week.
Have a friend staying with me, mm-hmm. so I've got an extra set of hands.
Great.
And because this isn't my first rodeo, and I do. Live in a big family,
mm-hmm.
And I come from a long line of entertainers. My mother's side of the family, the Bergens,
mm-hmm.
Notorious for their hospitality and food preparation.
Yes.
What I'm saying is my DNA was born for a moment like this.
Okay, but what I need to know then, so we...
So you prep ahead of time is what I'm trying to say.
But you've identified you're the turkey.
Yeah.
You're at least a couple of pies because you had an
yeah.
S on the
yeah,
end
I'm
of pie.
Yeah, I'm going to do two pies.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What else are you putting yourself in responsibility for?
I think
for?
The mashed potatoes, because I can do the mashed potatoes ahead of time.
Okay.
I know how to reheat them in the oven. And again, like for me, the turkey and the mashed potatoes and gravy.
Uh-huh. And the gravy,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, have
okay.
to be perfect. And then everything else with the side, you can do a hit or miss or
okay.
hit or miss.
Okay.
If I have time, I have two other sides that I want to make.
Which are?
Macaroni and cheese.
Oh, yeah.
Because you don't usually have it, but you always kind of want a bite or two,
uh-huh.
right?
Uh-huh.
And a nice homemade stuffing. I mean, not just like from a box, but I mean like
yeah.
bread, fresh herbs, fresh broth coming together for the perfect kind of souffle, bread souffle
mm-hmm,
versus
mm-hmm.
stuffing. But I just love it so much.
Have I told you my Thanksgiving story about macaroni and cheese? A few years ago, I found myself in service from a church and away from home for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And we were invited over into this woman's home for Thanksgiving dinner. And I was like, oh, man, this is my first Thanksgiving away from home. And I was like, there's going to be the turkey and the mashed potatoes,
yeah, you
the gravy,
have expectations.
All of these things. And I just was like, yeah, okay. And, you know, we get there on Thanksgiving mid-afternoon, knock on the door, get let in, and, you know, we're hanging out and waiting for it. And it wasn't but maybe a couple minutes into it that I'm like, it does not smell like a turkey is being prepared in this home for, as part of Thanksgiving dinner. But I didn't think much of
yeah.
it. I thought, maybe... as it was starting to be the fashion at that time, maybe she ordered it from a grocery store or a local
kind of prep.
And was going to go get it and then bring it in or whatever the thing may be. Nope. Lo and behold, about 10, 15 minutes later, it's like, let's eat. And I kept looking around for all the turkey and accoutrement that would go along with the turkey. And what ended up happening was one of those disposable... like aluminum tins,
yeah. mm-hmm.
probably the size of like an oil pan. So it's a massive thing. Comes out and it takes two hands by this woman for her to be able to take it out of the oven and hoist it up
Ooh.
Onto the top of the stove. And it was macaroni and cheese. And my instant thought was, wait a minute, this is Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
like
yeah, what are we doing?
This is
what are
the
we
day
doing?
That we do it. Come to find out, the tradition in her family was you just have macaroni and cheese that has all sorts of delicious
yeah,
things mixed into it.
Yeah.
That pan of macaroni and cheese, it is not a joke for me to say it probably weighed 25 or 30 pounds
oh my gosh.
With all of the stuff
yeah.
that was in it. I have never had a better macaroni and cheese ever.
Oh,
and
I
so
bet.
They're on Thanksgiving sort of missing out on the turkey
the
and those things.
Of home.
But being able to share in that tradition
oh,
with,
wow.
with that woman. And she's like, my mom, her mom before her. Because
yeah.
I felt comfortable at that point to be able to be like, so, I mean, we thought kind of turkey. She's like, oh, no. Turkey you can have anytime. This is what we only make on this day. And it was
unreal. Okay, that's it. I'm for sure making macaroni and cheese.
You should.
For
you
my
should.
Friendsgiving.
But what I'm worried about now is you've made five assignments for yourself.
I know, because it's what I want. And mm-hmm. also, I like to express love to my friends with food.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't do this very often. And certainly, Thanksgiving and our entire lives were so different with COVID.
Sure.
And we missed out on a lot. Am I trying to overdo it? Am I trying to make up for lost time?
Yes.
Yes and yes.
Yeah.
Do I have high expectations for this evening? Probably that there's no way that they can be met. Yes.
Yeah.
But that is life.
Yeah.
And I am diving in.
How many people are coming?
12.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's good. That's manageable.
Yeah. Not like, you know, if you're listening, you're like, hey, I'm Lisa's friend. Why didn't I get invited? You know, inviting people to certain Friendsgiving, it's a specific group.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And it's not for everyone. And I actually may, and don't hold me to this, do another Friendsgiving with a different set of friends.
Sure.
Because that's fun.
Yeah.
But you have to really think about that and the conversation and not too many people and enough place sure. settings and all of the things. So, you know, you can do this very casually. You can do it formally. I did once a Friendsgiving after Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And with the reinvented leftovers.
Okay.
Like I had a ton of leftover turkey and I was invited my friends over and I made these wonton turkey stuffing, mashed potato gravy, egg rolls.
Yeah.
And they were amazing. And
good
you dip
you.
Them in gravy or cranberry sauce. Listen. It's not a bad idea, and bringing people together, that's my love language.
I felt bad for a second because I've been checking my mailbox, and then you said, no, it's certainly something that you're doing electronically.
Refresh.
So I'm going to just go ahead and, would it be my work email you would have sent that to, or my Gmail?
You don't want to drive.
Yeah. I'm just looking. Servers must be down. I'll come back and check that later. Well, good. I hope that it is near everything you want it to be.
Listen, if there's going to be macaroni and cheese, what do I care?
Yeah.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on the BYU Radio app, where you can listen on demand. You can also find us on Sirius XM, channel 143.
I want to strongly encourage you to find The Lisa Show wherever you get podcasts and click subscribe. I want you to know that I am grateful for the subscribe button, that it allows you the opportunity to not miss a single second of The Lisa Show.
Thank you for making The Lisa Show a part of your day.